From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning across all these many prolific time zones, from the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands in the west to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands in the east, north to the pole, south well into South America, worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Good evening, good morning, as it may be. In a moment, we will be joining the gathering at the Civic Plaza Ballroom in Phoenix, Arizona. That will occur between now and midnight. At midnight, we will join Linda Moulton Howe and Doug Ruby. There have been some incredible new crop circles. So you're going to want to go on to the web right now for two big reasons. One, we've got a split-screen operation going on, so as you listen to the audio, you'll be able to, if you click on the split screen, the studio cam split screen, you'll be able to see, as well as hear, what's going on in Phoenix. On the right-hand side and on the left-hand side, you'll be able to see me doing the show here in Nevada. So it's a grand experiment in technology, and I can only hope it works as about a million people head up to the web. You're also going to want to download quickly, take a look at the Alton Barnes crop circle, because that'll be a subject for later discussion. Welcome, KSWD AM in Seward, Alaska. Glad to have you on board, 950 AM in Seward, Alaska, and KTHO in Lake Tahoe. That'd be South Lake Tahoe, California. Welcome aboard. Glad to have you. So, in a moment, we'll head down to Phoenix. All this technology works. We're now going to go to the Civic Plaza Ballroom in Phoenix, Arizona, where Richard Hoagland and company are. Let's see if we can do that. All right, we are trying to go down to Phoenix right now. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Art.
Hi, it's Richard.
How are you, my friend?
I'm just fine. I understand you're in front of thousands there, and better you than me.
We have had a rather remarkably interesting 4 hours. Ladies and gentlemen in the audience here, would you like to tell Art how interesting you have thought it was?
That makes me nervous just to hear that. So, good evening, everybody. Richard, what you could do for the national audience would be to sort of encapsulate, and I know that's hard for you, Richard, what's happening this evening so far.
Well, let's see. How should I begin? What I'd like to do is to have each of our presenters, who are mic'd and seated and ready, encapsulate briefly their part of the evening. And all I'll say is that for the last 15 years, we have been investigating an astonishingly interesting mystery on another world. And right now, tonight, and I will say it on Art Bell's show, I am now convinced that we are more than likely on that other world with Pathfinder.
Now, wait a minute. I want to hear some applause for that.
However, there is a catch, Art.
Of course, Richard.
There is new news, all right? We will get to the new news shortly. As part of this 15 years, we've been looking at patterns. All science begins in patterns. So as you and the audience of the Art Bell Show well know, this pattern has taken us from Cydonia through hyperdimensional geometry, sacred geometry to a lot of people, to a physics, to terrestrial connections, to ancient Egypt. And as part of that unraveling of those patterns, we have discovered the most astonishing connection to the city of Phoenix, and a connection which appears to be about to play out in the near-term future, that is, sometime between July 20th and July 26th of 1997, a few days from now. And so what I did as part of my part of the program was to lay out with visuals and computer plots and diagrams not only the visuals we have from Cydonia and the analysis of the monuments of Mars, but also the discovery of this remarkable tetrahedral hyperdimensional arcane pattern in the landing dates and launch dates and times and coordinates of most of the major NASA missions to the moon and beyond, including Mars itself, a pattern which continues up through Pathfinder with its tetrahedral shape, its designated landing at 19.5, and on and on. And what I did in the early part of the evening was to present one of our key investigators, who was not a scientist, who was not a hard empirical person. Her name is Kinsia. She is the art director of the Enterprise mission and has been for the last 15 years. Because what Kinsia did long before the development of three-dimensional computer programs that could make 3D renderings of two-dimensional data, shape from shading is the term, Kinsia did it the hard way. She has probably spent hundreds of hours sculpting and sculpting and sculpting again the face on Mars, the Martian Sphinx, the provable counterpart now to the echoing and ancient and mysterious Sphinx here on Earth in ancient Egypt. And sitting on the far left of the stage, there is a large sculpture placed in against black and lit appropriately, which is the work of her own hand. So let me introduce Kinsia, and you might ask her about the artistic aspect of this search and what has brought her as part of our team to Phoenix.
All right.
Kinsia?
Hello, Kinsia. Kinsia, your voice, for some reason, is not coming through as Richard's was. No, I think that for some reason your microphone is not hot to our line.
All right. I'm at the other microphone.
Okay, now everything's fine. Welcome to the program, Kinsia.
Well, hello, Art, and hello, everyone out there. I began this adventure 15 years ago, and like everyone else, we were really curious to experience what it might be like to be on Mars and to look out at the face. And at that time, I realized, well, it was within my reach to possibly create something that all of us could experience it together. And one of the challenges was to put aside my artistic freedom and to focus on the data. And so at that time, I set up two independent light sources to simulate the two sun angles. And I sculpted this face for the past 14 years, three different times, each time literally recreating it over and over again, because when I would complete it at the low sun angle and then I would move the sun up to the light up to the high sun angle, it wouldn't be correct, so I'd have to re-sculpt it again, and then I'd move it back to the low sun angle, and again, that would be the same problem. And later on, I was very gratified when Dr. Mark Carlotto, with his imaging techniques, was able to confirm the profile and a lot of the shapes of the face, and it's been quite a wonderful adventure. I'd also like to mention, Art, here, that we surprised Richard totally, because a year ago, my friend Jim Grassroot, who at the time I didn't know him, approached me as and described himself as one of the ordinary people out there, and said that he wanted to create something to honor the pioneers, those who are opening up our thinking, and he enlisted me in a project, which was to sculpt the face one more time. And he fashioned this beautiful wooden tetrahedron, and we created a gold medallion of the Mars face on the side. And tonight, we presented this to Richard to commemorate the landing of Pathfinder, but also to honor Richard and the other researchers who are contributing to opening our vision and our future and our past. And we call it the commemorative Mars tetrahedron, and totally stunned, Richard, I can assure you.
Well, if anybody deserves a sculpted tetrahedron, it is Richard. I would like to add that So far, with regard to this amazing mission to Mars, and there is a new little glitch tonight being reported upon, what we have found at the 19.5 rough landing spot are red rocks, similar to those on Earth. And I wonder how the audience there feels about the apparent spot they have landed versus the most interesting spot on Mars, which obviously is Cydonia.
Well, sir, asking for comments from the audience, folks, I'll relay it up here. The tetrahedron is red.
Yes.
So is Arizona.
And so is Arizona. Yes, that's right. But it is rather amazing that where they have landed so far, basically, I read a piece in a newspaper the other day, all we have found are red Earth-like rocks. It really does boil down to that.
Art, can you hear me on this mic?
No, well, I hear you, Richard, but not as though that mic were live.
Now can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Aha. We have a portable mic, which actually works. What we intended to do was to have some people from the audience, if anybody wants to respond to Art's question. Anybody? The microphone is way out there? It's behind the camera, okay.
Yeah, there's a standing mic here if you want to go up to
where,
the mic.
Where the lights are, there's a standing mic. Anybody who has a comment, come up, form a line.
I think I do. I'd like to make the comparison that in Sedona, Arizona, we have red rocks. And Cydonia, Mars, has red rocks.
Very well said. The point that I was trying to make is that since we apparently have landed where we have landed, we've found a lot of rocks and given them very cute names, but I have yet to see any sort of revelation that might rival that which we would find if we went to Cydonia.
Well, see, this has been my problem for some time. Back during the planning of the Pathfinder mission, it was obvious that if you wanted to set a spacecraft down inside the confines of the complex on Mars, if you wanted to set it in the city square or next to the pyramids or maybe down next to the face, the kind of rocket thrust descent on your own jet exhaust approach of Viking 20 years ago simply wouldn't make it, because of the unevenness of the terrain and the possibility of, you know, angular things sticking up out of the ground and perhaps even artifacts on a scale much smaller than we could see in any photographs, you probably would crash. So the airbag technology, this incredibly interesting and highly suspect tetrahedral airbag technology, seemed perfect for setting a spacecraft down at Cydonia if one so desired. That, of course, only left the political will. Well, what I find remarkable, Art, is that again and again during this mission, I cannot count how many times various team members, flight controllers, members of the general public, you know, friends of mine like John Holloman at CNN, have all discussed the aspect of finding life on Mars. We're going to find life on Mars someday. We're going to find evidence of water. We're going to find evidence of fossils. We're going to find the chemistry in the soil or in the rocks at this Pathfinder landing site. Life on Mars. We must find life on Mars. While over the hill, a few miles away, reachable by this spacecraft if someone had so deigned to aim her there, this spacecraft could have given us the definitive information if there ever had been life on Mars. And we blew it.
All right, Richard, my question to you and to any of the people, the experts you may have there, is since we apparently have landed where we have, my question is simply why?
How many hours do we have in your show, Art?
Never enough, Richard.
Well, the simple answer is that if this pattern we have been presenting now in Phoenix to a packed audience here in the Civic Plaza of citizens of the city of Phoenix has any meaning going back 30, 35, 40 years, then the mission we are seeing is a cover for some other kind of mission. Now, I on your show predicted that, in fact, this mission, this spacecraft, would disappear en route to Mars and then reappear, landing in accordance with this stunning pattern, which Ken Johnston has affirmed is a very ancient Masonic tradition, and would land on or about the 20th and then be revealed to us in some rather celebratory fashion. That apparently has not taken place. So, of course, for several days, I was in a deep, deep slump. Are you with me so far?
I am. And I must tell you, Richard, I have had many, many faxes and communications indicating that, you know, this is a cheaper, faster way to go. Maybe they did not one, but two.
Well, there is that waiting in the wings. Remember, we're trying to do science, so let's be serious for a second here. What I have done is to literally add up, either mentally and or sometimes on paper over the last few days, two lists. Evidence in favor that we're literally at 19.5 on Mars with a tetrahedral Pathfinder spacecraft and a little rover named Sojourner, and other evidence that we're not. And the evidence that we're not is not insignificant. And if you want to, we can go through that. But I want to get to the core of your question, which is, if we've landed at a dull and boring site, where all we're finding is Earth-type rocks, which is incredibly suspicious, given that nothing we have found in the previous 20 years of the Viking database and or the SNCC meteorite analyses, that is, the little bits and pieces of Mars that supposedly have been kicked off by giant asteroid or comet impact, made their way to Earth and been found in the Antarctic and brought back to the labs in Houston, like the cousins of ALH-800084, which is the rock with the so-called little microfossils in it.
Yes.
None of that analysis in any way, shape, or form has prepared the geologists that I have been able to watch for what they apparently are getting from the Pathfinder data. It's astonishingly different. It's astonishingly, I'm going to use the word, Earth-like. And that raises some very interesting questions. So, let me get to the possible hidden agenda. What we have discovered in our evening's travels through the last 30 years of NASA is that some core group, some Masonic influence, has literally fashioned the space program that we know. The key linchpin in the continuing ability to put Pathfinder and Sojourner in that pattern, even if we have landed at 19.5, not at Cydonia, on July 4th, is the following two pieces of information. On July 4th, 1776, a branch of the Mason Order, called the Illuminati, was formally formed, a kind of a dissident group. So that in itself is an interesting data point. More significant, there is a piece of evidence which has come to me from our crack research team, who actually has a name. His name is Nick Skouros, all right, and I want to give him proper name, proper credit, who found for me in an ancient journal of Freemasonry the following statement. The Hebrew word ger, which we translate as a sojourner, signifies a man living out of his own country and is used in this sense throughout the Old Testament. The children of Israel were therefore during the captivity sojourners in Babylon, and the person who was represented by this officer performed, as the incidents of the degree relate, an important part in the restoration of the Israelites to Jerusalem. He was the spokesman and leader of a party of three sojourners and is therefore emphatically called the chief or principal sojourner. In the English royal art system of Masonry, there are three officers called sojourners. But in the American system, that's the Scottish Rite, the three historical sojourners are represented by the candidates, while only the supposed chief of them is represented by an officer called the principal sojourner.
All right, Richard, I must interrupt you because we're at the bottom of the hour right now. And I think that I get the idea. And we will be sojourning back to you in a few moments. All right, I think we've reconnected. Richard, we're back on the air.
Okay. What I'd like to do is we have two presenters who have some interesting new news on fronts that we have covered on your show previously.
All right.
Francis Barwood is here. And... has a very strong following here in Phoenix. And what I'd like her to do is to give a summation of, we had Jim Del Toso present an analysis of the Phoenix Lights with Bill Hamilton. And one of the things that came out of the analysis is not only did the lights appear over Phoenix when Mars was at 19.5 degrees, but when Bill Hamilton presented the analysis of the track of the trajectory from the northwestern part of the state down across Phoenix, down
yes.
to the sun,
yes.
the angle of flight to the meridian, to the north-south line, was, according to Bill, also 19.5 degrees. So whatever was flying the lights apparently is aware of the NASA slash Masonic slash tetrahedral slash hyperdimensional slash Sidonia pattern.
All right. Slash hello, Francis.
Hi, Art.
Hi, Francis. Great to hear you again. You're a very brave lady. Francis, I simply said, wonderful to hear you again. I consider you to be a very brave lady indeed.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's really good to talk to you again. I was going to run through kind of the synopsis of the things that happened because of some people in the audience don't know exactly. Or we've tried to keep you pretty much up to date with facts and things. But if you don't mind, I'll start going over it.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Starts with March 13th, which is when everybody but me apparently saw these lights over Phoenix. And I was in a meeting that night and got home about 10 minutes to 10, turned on the TV and saw in the news there were these lights. And everybody said, I wonder what they are. And I just assumed that it was some plane off course and that they were going to investigate. And that was it until May 6th. On May 6th, as I was running late for policy session, I was stopped by a TV camera crew and a reporter. They literally jumped out of the bushes and shoved a microphone in my face and said, nobody will talk to us, will you? And I said, okay, that's fine. And I said, what's the problem? They said, you know, these lights that were over Phoenix, nobody wants to investigate. So I'm thinking, what lights over Phoenix? And they said, well, back on March 13th. And I said, oh, well, I thought somebody was investigating. And they said, no, and could you find out why they went to every level of government and nobody would even talk to them, especially the city of Phoenix. So I went into policy session, and it happens to be our only televised session. And at the beginning, we get a chance, and it's called council request, and we can ask any question that we want. And that's usually where I get in trouble. I've been on the council for 5.5 years, and I've asked some questions that, you know, were pretty uncomfortable for the city to answer, and this was not one of the tough ones. And I think we had the soundtrack from that day. Do you want to play that?
I think I'm going to mention this because I'm a little curious. I was stopped outside by a television crew who was asking about the lights that were over Phoenix. Weeks ago, and apparently the enforcement, nobody was doing any investigation on it, and I'd just like to know if anybody has any information from the city and if the city is checking into it. Apparently, from what I saw on television, it was about the size of a football field, and there was 7 mics, and they all moved together like they were attached to something, so we don't know if it was a prank or you know, something that was just
news
out there, but, you know, kind of curious, especially since people
are starting
to ask more questions.
Thank you. After I asked that question, I guess this one's not really working. Okay. After I asked that question, there was this silence, and I was told after the meeting that I shouldn't have asked the question, that I was opening Pandora's box, and that the city really didn't want to deal with it, and I had asked the man that he was a staff member, deputy city manager, and I asked him, you know, why was anybody afraid to ask that? And he said, I don't know, they just don't want to deal with this at all, and they've been avoiding the media like the plague. And there was a statement issued from the mayor's office that said that there are no UFOs over Phoenix. So
sarcastic that I am, I figured if there was no UFOs, they must have identified them, and I want to know what it was.
I saw, Francis and everybody, the picture you had of a little while ago of exactly what was over Phoenix. And I would suggest to the audience everywhere in America that anybody who would not want the answer to what was that is not a proper leader for their community. Now, I have in my hand a letter that apparently is dispatched to everybody who complains to the mayor of your city about the treatment you have been receiving. And it reads, Dear Mr. Blank, thank you for your interest in Phoenix. Mayor Rimza has yet to comment publicly on Councilwoman Barwood's flying saucer inquiry, so I'm not certain exactly what behavior you are asking him to apologize for. Incidentally, while all Americans should support their president, Mayor Rimza was the county chairman of the Dole for President Committee, which makes your reference to the contrary perplexing. I don't know if there are flying saucers out there or not, but clearly there is a great deal of misinformation for no good reason regarding the mayor. Perhaps we should pay a little more attention to planet Earth. Signed, Scott Phelps, assistant to the mayor. And I wonder if that advice also goes from the assistant to the mayor to the governor, who had quite a good time with the whole thing.
Well, you know, that's the type of sarcasm that's been coming out of the mayor's office. And I'll tell you, if one of my staff members had ever written a letter like that to any one of my constituents, or any citizen of the United States, it wouldn't be my staff member anymore. So it's that type of sarcasm and rudeness that has permeated this entire thing. As you know, I'm under recall. Again, it's on again. And it's on and off. They're actually challenging it again. But on the, May 10th, I asked the question on May 6th, and then on May 10th was when the article appeared in the paper. And I started getting phone calls from 7:30 that morning. I hadn't even seen the paper, and it was real interesting. It didn't stop. People called me from all over the state that had seen something, and they really wanted to know what it is, and especially from Phoenix. On the 12th, the recall was activated again because I guess they felt that was a good way to let me know. On the 16th, the city gave their response. And
ask
for the overhead. Okay, do the overhead. The city gave their response. And one of the things that they said was the city of Phoenix does not have an Air Force. I kind of knew that. they also said that the police department received less than 5 phone calls, and so that it was not significant. Well, the news that night on March 13th had interviewed a spokesperson for the police department, a Sergeant Mike Torres, and at the main police station, and they said they were being overwhelmed with phone calls.
I wonder, Francis, if those 5 people are in the audience tonight.
I think probably times 100. Then the next thing that happened on the overhead was a sign on the picture in my picture in the lobby that said that I was from the planet Xenon. Then on May 22nd is my letter to Senator McCain, which I requested that he investigate the lights over Phoenix. His reply to me, which was on the 28th, replies about the lights on South Mountain, which is the same thing that the city. Now, when you heard what I said that day, never did I say anything about lights on South Mountain. I always said the lights over Phoenix. But the response to me always came back, the lights on South Mountain. So then Senator McCain sent a letter on the 28th also to Major General Lansford Trapp. And he in turn sent it to the Blue Book Archives, of which it ended up in their trash because they don't investigate. On June 3rd, I sent a clarification letter to McCain saying I wasn't talking about lights on South Mountain. I was talking about the lights over Phoenix. And on... It's not going? Okay. I'll go back to the overhead. Maybe we can get to the June 10th article. Okay, well, I'll tell you about it anyway. On June 10th, the mayor's office and both the mayor and his press secretary, who is now his chief assistant, were handing out business cards with my name on it, which said Frances Emma Barwood, and I think that's one of the last ones. Okay, there it is. It said Frances Emma Barwood from the planet Xenon, talking to the tinfoil, and she will hear you. I didn't know that they were handing out these cards. It was apparently going on for a couple of weeks before I received one, but, you know, it's that type of interesting intellect that does those things.
Well, Frances, in honor of you, one night I made up a great big aluminum foil hat and then removed it from my head and spoke into it, and I said, Mr. Mayor, please listen to your city council. And I spoke into the aluminum foil. I don't know that it had any specific effect.
I can hear you. He's pretty dense. But I think, you know, that's one of the things. And my topic for tonight was the intimidation factor. And if I could say anything, I think this is it. Every elected official that has stuck their neck out and asked something or probed into something, you know what has happened to them. And I've been under a lot of attack. And I have to tell you that I'm the youngest of five kids, and I grew up asking questions because I was told, if you ask a question, you cannot get in trouble. However, I've asked a lot of questions and I've gotten in a lot of trouble, but that's okay, because if you don't seek the truth, you're never going to find it. And if you're afraid to ask a question, you might as well just close yourself in a closet and stay there, because the most important thing to do is to probe. And that's why I admire you and I admire Richard, is because you're not afraid to probe into anything. And hopefully someday we'll get an answer from the city of Phoenix.
Hopefully one day. Francis, I want to thank you so much. And I think all of the audience nationwide has followed what you've been going through. And even if it turns out, Francis, that you are, for asking a question, politically ejected, you'll be able to sleep at night and hold your head up, and that certainly will not be true of many others who work for the city of Phoenix.
Well, I've never sold my soul yet, and I don't intend to do it now.
Well, my congratulations go out to you.
Art, I have something for you and something for Richard, but I can't give it to you right now, so I'll send it to you. But I have a pin from the city of Phoenix. It happens to have a symbol of the Phoenix bird, and I thought that was very appropriate.
It certainly is, and I'll look forward to it, Francis. Thank you.
There it is, Art.
Art, did you hear that?
Yes, I did.
Yes. you may have launched an interesting new political career tonight.
Richard, is it possible for you to summarize for the audience? Everybody wants to know, and it really is important. What is it? What are your expectations for the city of Phoenix? Can you be fairly clear about it in a fairly short amount of time?
Art, there are over 1,000 people here who have sat through 4 hours of non-digested information and non-condensed, so they know the magnitude of what you're asking. However, we shall try. What I would like to do, rather than myself answering the question, I would like to put on two other people who were part of our panel, Ken Johnston Sr., who, of course, you know, former NASA test astronaut, member of the esteemed NASA team that got us to and from the moon, current member of the Boeing family, and a 32nd degree Mason, who has been regaling us with some very interesting insights on Masonry and this connected Masonic pattern now that goes all the way back through ancient Egypt and beyond. And then following him, I think that Vance Davis, who is a former member of the National Security Agency, an analyst, who has been delving into the history of Phoenix, and who presented an overview connecting the Masonic origins of Phoenix with the information Ken presented. And literally, while we've been on the air, people have been sending us information through the Internet. There have been local people here in the audience presenting cards who were part of an historic retrieval effort on their own. There are some archaeologists who presented some amazing new connections that literally now solidify the proposal that Phoenix is very special as a special site even before Swilling and Dupa and the others established the city over 120 years ago.
All right, Richard, we have only a couple of minutes left before the top of the hour, and there are many, many people who would like to understand your projections for an event that will occur somewhere between the 20th, I think you said, and the 26th. Can you give us some idea of what it is you expect to occur?
Okay. Up until tonight, what we did not have was the key piece of new evidence, which, as I said, Vance, has just been handed, that the ancient Hohokam Indians and the previous civilizations that lived in this valley, the Valley of the Sun, had as their totems, as their significant symbols, the same phoenix bird of resurrection that the ancient Egyptians used as their symbol of rebirth and new life and a new age. Something that occurred over this city on March 13th, the so-called Phoenix Lights, has appeared now according to this tetrahedral Masonic 19.5 degree pattern. There is tonight a spacecraft ostensibly on Mars at 19.5 degrees. On the 20th of July at 4:55 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, all over the inner solar system, an extraordinary Phoenix-like pattern. This tetrahedral pattern of key stars involving that mythology will occur over the horizon of Tranquility on the Moon, of Cydonia on Mars, of the Pathfinder site at 19.5 on Mars, over the Giza Plateau, and over the city of Phoenix itself. To quote from a movie, 2010, when the astronaut appears to the head of NASA in the spaceship orbiting Jupiter and says, "Something wonderful will happen."
Yes.
It is our projection that something is going to happen here between the 20th and the 26th. Whether it will be wonderful depends fully on how prepared and alert and inquisitive the citizens of Phoenix in this room and elsewhere truly become.
All right. Well, that's quite a statement. Apparently you don't. You're not going to be more specific than that. Do you
be more specific?
Do you expect it to be something wonderful or something worrisome? If you were living in Phoenix, Richard, would you find a reason to be out of town during those dates?
Art.
Yes.
It's a Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. The citizens of Phoenix are living in very interesting times and a place.
Indeed they are. All right, Richard, we are going to break here at the top of the hour and turn it back to you. We'll probably be back at about 7 minutes past the hour. And we will continue then with Ken Johnson and Vance Davis. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert, joined once again after the top of the hour by Richard Hoagland and the multitudes at the Civic Plaza Ballroom in Phoenix, Arizona. Stay right where you are. There is more to come. Richard Hoagland and company. Are you there?
From the low desert, as opposed to those other places. Hi, Art.
Hello, Richard.
Okay, what we want to do now is to put you in touch with Ken Johnston. Because what Ken has done tonight for the folks here in the ballroom is to limb out not only the prehistory of this ancient tradition to which they are a part and have not until recently realized it, but then we're going to segue with Vance Davis into the actual formation of the city on that tradition, and we've had very important new news come in literally this evening.
All right, Richard, may I interject and give you a little bit of news?
Absolutely.
I just received a fax, and I've been getting several of these over the last several days. Are you or is Mr. Hoagland aware of a huge UFO hovering over LaGrange, Georgia, right now? The craft has already been seen by well over 10,000 people. It is hovering over the town at an altitude of about 10,000 feet, so it's clearly visible to everyone. This may be the beginning of something big from Thomas Trent in LaGrange, Georgia.
Well, what we need is video, and we need to get it to Keith, and we need to get it up on the web so we can all look at it.
I agree completely, and I the reason I read this is because I've had communications from the director of MUFON in that area indicating indeed this is going on, Richard.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, having not seen the data, all I can say is it sounds provocative, and it certainly fits the prescription of something is going to happen. The question is where?
The question is where, and something... In other words, Richard, and for the people of the city of Phoenix and everybody there in the audience, you really are not certain whether this will be something wonderful or something somewhat less than wonderful. You're simply assuring everybody that something is indeed going to occur. Is that correct?
Well, look, on your program, when we did the program a few weeks ago, I made a very specific commitment to look at the evidence that was surrounding this particular forecast. The evidence is neutral. The evidence is very affirming. I mean, the whole concept of the Phoenix mythology is something new being born from the old. Now, what we have discovered is that the sighting of Phoenix here in southwest U.S., in Arizona, at 3333 south, is not at all accidental. And the new information, which is that the sighting of Phoenix was predicated on the ancient Indian culture, who themselves apparently believed in and left totems to this identical Phoenix resurrection, rebirth, a glorious new day morning legend, that obviously is telling us something profound. Now, human beings are very contrary. There is almost a karmic law that if something really neat and wondrous and insightful is about to happen, there's a few folks that want to spoil the party. What I don't want to do is to magnify the negative and the dark side of the force here in the face of something which transcends all of that, and if we approach it in the proper light, I think is significant in the largest degree based on the 30-plus year pattern we have been analyzing.
All right, but I want to pin you down. It's not easy to do, Richard. The symbol of the phoenix rising from the ashes obviously implies that before the rising, there will be ashes.
Call him a fear monger.
I simply am trying to understand the chain of logic here. And
well, the problem is that we're dealing at the level of metaphor and symbology, and you sound a little bit like Zachariah Sitchin, who I love dearly, but Zach wouldn't know a metaphor if he tripped over it. Look.
30 years between
the whole thesis is that there is a long time span for these events. If we are correct, our entire civilization from the Egyptians on has been part of a rebirth from the ashes of what came before. Now, we've gone through various interregnums and various dark ages. One would certainly not think, if one looked at certain parts of our political system, that it couldn't use some rebirthing and reborning. You know, now, whether one views ashes in the literal sense or in the metaphorical and allegorical sense is strictly up to you. The fact is that we live at the level of symbol, and in fact, if we were to discover tomorrow, Art, that we are emphatically not alone, if some other species were to make that known, and the fact that we are somehow connected with them and with events on a much larger stage, then metaphorically our entire myopic 6,000-year civilization is thrown into the ash can. It's history, literally.
So, all right, the people of Phoenix, then, need not fear some necessary physical event. It may be a metaphorical occurrence, or it may be something that is revealed to us all. That is, in essence, what you're saying.
What I am saying is that there are rumors of war before every major new event.
Yes, and the audience, Richard, should know that you and I have been both dealing with, I really want to get this out on the table. The internet is rife with rumors of troops and troop movements. I've received, I can't tell you how many messages, and I don't read them on the air because I think that it would lead to some panic. And I don't even know if they're true. Nobody can know about these internet messages, but indeed, the internet is rife with these rumors, and I think that ought to be out on the table and at least known by everybody there.
Let me pose a scenario for you. Let's assume, I mean, you saw the movie Close Encounters, right?
I certainly did. I've had one myself.
Well, in Close Encounters, for, as Jim Delatoso said, those folks who have been hiding in the Antarctic, you know, over the last several years, there is an event that comes to pass. A set of signal tones are sent, which are ultimately cracked by a code person,
yes,
the film, who then goes and literally opens a locked office where a globe is rolled out into the project floor, and they use the tone code to pinpoint a latitude and longitude in the film, right?
Correct.
And that latitude and longitude, we are told, is Devil's Tower, Wyoming. And a landing, an event of great magnitude, First Contact, which, by the way, is a film just out this week from my erstwhile friend Carl Sagan, is the name of the show. That's where the government, the powers that be, are informed through this tonal communication that contact will occur.
You might be interested to know that this evening, this very night, Richard, the President of the United States has had his attorneys contact the producers, or the producer of that film, objecting to the use of his image and his name to be connected with it at all.
Yeah, I know. Mr. Zemeckis said something on CNN to the effect that you can't trust any images that you see anymore. Gosh, where have we heard that before? Anyway, that notwithstanding, the interesting trivia that I'm going to reveal right now about Close Encounters is it is a code for Cydonia. If you look at the film, and I would have brought my copy with to play here, but as you know, we have moved, and I could not find my copy, and I couldn't get the Blockbuster. But if you look at the film, and you look at the map, and you look at the latitudes and longitudes of Devil's Tower, you will find they are in error by over 300 miles.
My, my.
The actual latitude given in the film is the latitude of Cydonia from Viking on Mars. And the reason is because Dr. Sagan was good friends with Steven Spielberg, and Steven, as all great artists, hid as an anagram in the film a forecasting of something possibly to come. Now, if there are rumors of military activity in the Phoenix area, and if there are sightings of vehicles and tanker trucks and armed personnel, one of the benign interpretations I would have is that someone has been clued in, per the Phoenix lights, per the electric switch that was thrown a couple days ago, Art, which you agreed was pretty manipulative.
Yes.
And there is some anticipation by the powers that be that something is going to happen. And the natural response of human beings, particularly in the last 6,000 years, to any inflection of the curve is fear and loathing and terror. So the military, doing their job, must be prepared for the unknown. That does not mean that the negative unknown has to occur. It merely means that they are on the inside and may know a little bit more than we on the outside, who are projecting a separate set of curves and arriving possibly at the same destination.
I really think that what you are suggesting is entirely possible, and that they are in preparation for some event that they foresee as you have foreseen. Richard, I would be curious, I don't have a map in front of me, but the latitude of Georgia as a state is generally fairly consistent with that of Phoenix or with Arizona, is it not?
Well, if you give me a town, I've got redshift here, I can actually go in. If you give me a town, I'll see. Find me a reasonably large location.
Well, it's north of Atlanta, and you're being heard in Atlanta right now. LaGrange, Georgia, is some miles north of Atlanta, Richard, not very far.
About 30 miles north.
Okay.
30 miles north, yeah.
Well, it may take a couple of minutes here to get this program to work properly, but...
I think I'm beginning to think like Richard Hoagland.
Okay. If I can have the computer on here, fellas. All right, towns and cities. We'll start out with Atlanta. We have 142 kilometers to the centimeter. We'll look at sites. And where are we here? Running down the list. Okay. It's south?
Just north of Atlanta, Richard.
North of Atlanta, okay. I'm hearing from voices here that it's south of Atlanta.
Well, okay, north or south. I'm sorry, I also do not have a map. I know that it is within miles of Atlanta.
All right. I will put it right there. It's 3324, and if we put it in downtown Atlanta, it's 3354. Split the difference, it's 3333. It's the same latitude.
Yes. Yes.
That is called real-time science, coast to coast.
And that is occurring right now. So, Richard, I'm going to endeavor by fax to have somebody in LaGrange before we get off the air. Please send me a fax at area code 702-727-8499, and I will try and get them on the air for both audiences, your live audience and my national audience. At any rate, Richard, please proceed.
Well, what I'd like to do is to continue, visitors notwithstanding, who may have something interesting to tell us at some point. One of our panelists wanted to know if you think they're coming our way.
Richard, without data points, being in the studio I am where you see me right now, I wouldn't endeavor to answer that question.
Good. Very good. All right. Let me put on Ken Johnston, because there is, from the terrestrial side, this extraordinarily ancient projective pattern, which I think is pretty important to telling what might happen next.
All right.
Without further ado, Ken?
Good evening, Art. Can you hear me?
Good evening, Ken. I hear you just fine.
Very good. Basically, what I ran down this evening was tracing the history of modern masonry all the way back. I outlined for the people here that there were about 14, there were 14 presidents that were Masons. I also went in and showed the other Masons who were involved in the forming the Constitution of the United States, the fact that we can establish that the United States, America, was the grand Masonic plan to put freedom in the hands of the people, to have government of the people, by the people, and for the people. From there, I pushed Masonry on back to England and through some of the research of many of the great researchers in Masonry, all the way back to Scotland, and from Scotland to the Knights Templars, and also discussed a lot about the Roslyn Chapel in Scotland, where a lot of the data has been buried, and we're in the process of trying to dig it up underneath. From there, we pushed Masonry back to Israel for the Knights Templars, and then from there to Herod's Temple under there, and then tying it into the religious side of Israel to Moses back to Egypt. And in turn, we're able to show that Masonry actually stems back to the followers of Horus, that this knowledge has been kept in allegory, symbols, and signs that 99% of the world's Masons have no idea of the history, although we have found the groups that have kept that. So from there, we were then looking at the fact that why does an organization that claims its history back to 1717 keep two calendars, such as this is the 14th of July, 1997, when in reality, in all Masonic lodges, it is actually the 14th of July, AL 5997, 5,997 years since the Great Light, which was the cataclysmic event that took place then. So we have a great history coming through here. And now it's been brought back up to modern times by Vance Davis.
All right. Thank you very much, Ken. And hi, Vance.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening.
And welcome to Phoenix, although through the Internet. I'm glad to see we're finally using it for what it needs to be used for.
This is absolutely a remarkable technology, and we could do a program on just this alone. It's amazing.
Well, what I did in starting a very limited research for Richard when I met him, I didn't know the problem I'd get into, came up and tracked back the history of the word Phoenix back to Egypt. Going through this all the way through Greece, by the way, an interesting little thing I didn't share with the audience here, Art, is the word Phoenix was also used in Greece to what they called palm trees. They called them Phoenixes. And, of course, Arizona and Las Vegas, we see palm trees. From there, we went through the Spanish with Columbus, the discovering of America, which in fact, Art, from my experience in the NSA, there's one thing they taught me when I first went in there as a naive 18-year-old that didn't know anything, that what we were taught in school as history is not history. That's a made-up history for the general public because of religious and sacrificial reasons. From there, we learned that Columbus was given a map of this land by Isabella. It already had a pre-map. In other words, he knew where he was going, Art. And it had on there the seven cities, which later we learned the Spanish were looking for one thing here, the seven cities of Cibola, or the seven cities of gold, as people know them. The interesting thing is, the last command given by the kings and queens was, by the way, while you're over there tracking the stories of the seven cities, please take the land in our name. That was the last order given. Forget everything else, you know. So from there, we tracked it to where Montezuma ran into the southwest after the conquistadors were chasing him. They killed him, of course. Coronado sent Juan de Onate into the area. He discovered the Grand Canyon in about 1540, and he called it back to Coronado the Big Ditch. Of course, it was never put on a map until 1883. Between 1871 and 1883, it was never included on any map of Mexico, the United States, or anywhere else. It was just left out.
All right, about a minute, Vance.
Yes. So we went from there, and what we found in doing the research, real fast, Art, I'm going to talk real fast like we do at NSA. Beep, 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 beep. No, I'm just kidding. In doing the research, I found the ancient city of the Hohokam, which was rumored to be one of the seven cities of Cibola. It held 100,000 people. What was interesting, when you hold it up to the light, and this will lead to Mr. Larry Hunter, when you hold it up and you put it in alignment with the River Nile and the Salt River here, they flow the same direction, Art, and you find that the Pueblos, which have basically all been destroyed by modern civilization, have certain interesting components in that they fit in other areas, and we're still researching this very heavily with science and figures.
All right, Vance, I'm going to have to halt it there. We'll be right back from the high desert. This is CBC. Going now back to Phoenix in this Civic Plaza Ballroom, where there are thousands listening to Richard Hoagland and company. Vance Davis, I'm afraid I had to interrupt Vance in the middle of something. I have one very quick piece of input. Vance, are you there?
I need to think. Yes, I'm
here. Hello, Art.
All right. Hold on, everybody, for just one moment. I have a caller from Georgia who is not seeing the objects claimed to be in the sky right now. Caller, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Where are you, please?
In Sugar Hill, Georgia.
Okay, and you have some information for everybody. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, after Reconstruction and the city of Atlanta burned down to the ashes?
Yes.
Guess what they adopted as their symbol?
The symbol of the city of Atlanta?
Yes, sir.
Is what?
The Phoenix.
I have a note here. Hand me that note, would you? There's a note, Art, from one of our listeners, it's from Jim Hertat. You know Jim.
I do indeed, yes.
In his book, The Keys of Enoch?
Yes.
Jim has identified Atlanta and the Phoenix as the eyes of the dove that gives a vision to an ushering in new age. Now, the fact that we're looking at very similar latitudes within minutes of arc. In other words, if we can get confirmation that there is something interesting going on over Georgia, it could be another part of the pattern. Now, I must tell you that Peter Davenport, who, of course, is an old friend of yours, is not reporting any calls from Georgia at this time regarding this object.
All right. It may well not be. Who knows? But there have been reports in the last several days. There's absolutely no question about it, Richard. I talked to a MUFON director there.
Okay.
Whether or not it's actually going on right now, we'll just have to check into it. I just wanted to simply let you know that, and I'm sorry I had to interrupt Vance Davis in the middle of where I was going, and we need to be able to get to Larry here because we've got some fairly shocking information for everybody.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to get to tonight was an overview, a cursory overview of our first analysis of SDS 80.
Yes.
I don't think we're going to be able to do it between now and midnight because we have new news on Larry Hunter's project and Enterprise. And I have a very important memo to read to you from a member of the Shore Expedition regarding the secret tunnel.
All right, we better get to it. Go ahead.
So what I would suggest, if you can, is that we maybe go from midnight to the bottom of the hour. Is that possible?
It's possible. I have other guests scheduled, Richard, so we better get to it.
Okay. Well, let me do one report here. Scotty Rowland, you know, our trustworthy engineer on the web,
yes,
reports that all the web servers maxed out since 10 p.m. The previous high was only one half of what we're doing right now. And that, of course, doesn't quite count Pathfinder, but I think we're a close second. And then I'm going to turn it now back to Vance to complete this very important part of the symbolic pattern he's discovered as part of the historical data retrieval research onto the history of Phoenix.
Hello, Art. I'm back.
Okay, go right ahead.
We're going to tie this together really quickly for you. It seems that the Hohokam heroes, the people were known as the people that left in 1400 A.D., as did the Anasazi and other tribes. They all left at the same time, disappeared. No, there's reasons and theories. What has happened when you lay the city of Phoenix, and I made a boo-boo earlier, I apologize to the audience in the United States and everything else, the Salt River here runs to the southwest. The Gila River runs north. Now, what's interesting, when you put the map with the Giza plateau map, you find that the rivers, whether they flow that way or not, symbolizes the Milky Way, from my view, and certain pueblos that were built by the Hohokam matches those of the cities and the temples in that area. Now, what I'm bringing in and what we're going to introduce here is Larry Hunter, who's worked as a navigator for 28 years and 18 years in Egypt, as you know. He was on your show for a period, if I remember right, a couple weeks ago. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And we showed him these pictures when he finally showed up in Phoenix, and he has something, and we are going to do science with this live on the Internet with Larry Hunter and with you, Art, over the airwaves.
All right.
Okay, and the history of Egypt. By the way, the Hohokam symbol for the city given to us tonight was a phoenix and petroglyphs all over South Mountain.
Absolutely amazing.
Here you go, Larry Hunter.
Evening, Richard. Or not Richard, but Art.
Good evening, Larry. Welcome back again. And for those who don't recall, Larry Hunter joined Richard as we explained what was going on in Egypt, basically a secret dig going from the king's to the queen's chamber for some unknown reason. And Larry Hunter actually sent me a piece of limestone from the center of the Great Pyramid. And Larry, it's all yours.
Thank you, Art. What I was going to do was take off the lead of Vance and kind of introduce what I had suggested to him, is that astroarchaeology is really a new science that, if we listen to the words of people, is that what's up above is also on the earth. Well, I spent a good amount of time in Egypt, as you know, and not only was I doing a project for Richard, but I have my own research that I was doing in conjunction at the same time. Overhead, please.
I'm sorry?
I'm putting up slides for the audience here.
All right.
They paid some good money, and they waited to hear a lot of this, so I'm kind of getting both of you at the same time.
Richard. All right.
All right. What you are seeing here is a GPS. This is a standard Garmin issue. They're about $200-$300. They're very cheap. And if you know how to move around using GPS, if you've got Acuras and you're lost, you can use those devices in the car to get to the supermarket if there's a traffic jam. But if you use it for higher purposes and you're very good at the sciences of astronomy and in navigation, what you're looking at here is a picture of this GPS as I was walking around the Great Pyramid on one of my trips over there surveying the site using this piece of equipment to lock down my position. And this particular photograph we're looking at is the southwest corner of the Great Pyramid and the GPS I've laid inside to tie the two together, just as a photograph for everyone out here. But this is the basic background of the science that I use because it's so easy and effective. I don't have the time to get sextants out and stopwatches and go through the whole navigation theorem to find and move myself around Egypt. So for about $300, I got me a GPS. But with the GPS now, we're going to click over onto the map here, back to the view. This is Cairo, all right? Cairo is, as you're looking at it, this is the river that would be running to the north. This is where we had a little conflict with Phoenix here and what Vance is trying to say. But to get back to Vance before I move into mine, is that we want to use the same techniques of astroarchaeology to locate the sites around the Phoenix area and see if they actually will plot the same kind of activity that I discovered in Cairo or the Giza Plateau, which was that every star in the Orion constellation, from the star Messia, which is the head of Orion, to the shoulders, which would be Betelgeuse and Bellatrix, on into the belts, Al-Natak, Al-Nalim, and Mintaka, down into the areas of M42 and M43, which is just below the three belts of Orion. Put this up here. Those M42 and 3 would be in this area right here of the Orion constellation. Those, along with Rigel and Safe, were located by me. Now, in that process of using GPS, using the right ascensions and declinations off of Redshift or Voyager or just basic standard navigation publications, you can pull these stars down and get the data off of them. But the technology today is really swift, and we can put these data into these machines and be on site within 45 minutes if you're around the Great Pyramid itself. But we did go through that process, and I have, again, tomorrow we're going to do a workshop between 5 and midnight, of which we will bring out about 100 pounds of the rocks that are associated with each of these areas that really aren't, according to Orthodox Egyptology, supposed to be in the patterns that they are, because it's too clear that this is the Orion constellation. And there's no books in the Egyptian Egyptology that will tell us that that is the case. But we're breaking new sciences here to go in and use astronomy and archaeology to find things that are relevant to us today.
Art, this is Dick Hoagland. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine.
Okay. One thing you need to know, the pattern that Larry has been working on and discovering and verifying with his GPS technology is much more ancient than the pattern that Robert Bavol believes he has discovered using only the three belt stars. And if Larry is correct, and I've looked at his data and I've looked at his map coordinates, and it appears that he knows how to use the GPS technology, it implies strongly that the Orion that the ancient Egyptians were modeling had drifted. The stars have moved relative to their current position, or even their position only 10,500 years ago. So what Larry is on the way to proving is that the constellation of Orion somehow was very meaningful to people possibly a million or more years ago. And he thinks I'm being very conservative.
All right. If you would, Richard, try and tell me, because I've listened to all this, but I don't quite understand what it all means. What is it you're telling us?
What we're trying to tell you, Art, is that everything that we know about Egyptology is basically, for whatever reason, not the truth. And truth is what's supposed to give us the ability to choose whether we want to believe what we've been told or what we're now hearing and seeing, because the evidence is self-supporting. The audience is now looking at a slide on the overhead, please. Like Star Trek, computer on. All right, we have as best we can get. We've got the cities of Heliopolis, Letopolis, Abu Awash, the Giza Plateau, the Three Pyramids, and then we have Zaliat El-Arian. This is the work of Robert Bavol, but Robert Bavol, in his placing, has called Zaliat El-Arian a city, or the star Bellatrix, which means he's looking in this area closer to the Nile for Betelgeuse, and he's never defined it. He also calls up Abu Awash, and he calls that the star Safe, which means that he should be looking in this area
according to the constellation of Orion layout, or Rigel. He can't find that one either. He hasn't located M42. He doesn't know where the head of Orion is, and I don't believe he's even been to Letopolis. And the reason I bring those points up is because in this Osiris text by Unas, 6th Dynasty Egypt, they will describe the body of Osiris as moving from Heliopolis, or On in that time in Egyptology, across the body of water, which is the Nile, and on into an area called Letopolis. Letopolis is a very interesting city. It's called Azum today. It's not this name at all. But there's a mosque on top of this area that supposedly a meteorite struck a long time ago, and in the opening mouth ceremony of the pharaohs and passing down Horus's right to rule after Osiris, it was all the priests stayed in this area here. And then from this area, he would move directly north. And by GPS, these two are identical. I locked on to this position during this last trip. And it is exactly 15.75 kilometers to the Great Pyramid on the north side, of which there is an entrance. In that entrance, I'm kind of trying to rush something through here that we didn't get to do before, so bear with us, is that on this overhead, this would be the north entrance. This is the entrance to the Great Pyramid today that was sort of lost. So I've taken and I'm trying to bring it in here. This is a modern picture from the Mena House looking at the north side of the Great Pyramid.
All right, Larry, we're going to have to move along here pretty quickly.
This is the north entrance at which the body would have been taken down, and through this, there was a gateway that Osiris went to become Orion. That's a lot of mythology, but in science, it makes a lot of sense dealing with what we're dealing with now, with the activities that are going on in the pyramid concerning secret chambers, illegal digging, my experiences in Egypt over the last 18 years, and most currently about the last 8 or so since the administration of Hawass has taken the chairmanship of, or the director position of the Great Pyramid. Richard has sent me over there. You've seen a piece of this rock. What a lot of people don't know is by the stories of the modern village pyramid workers, I know all about the inside of the Great Pyramid, so much so that I don't know if I want to talk about it. But anyway, we're showing them art for you in a refresher. The Grand Gallery approaching up, there's ladders here. I have video from 1996 in September that will not show these ladders tied to these rails. Again, in a refresher for this audience that may not have caught your broadcast on the 26th, it takes the signature of a wasp to undo those knots to put that ladder on the side of this wall, of which they will crawl up to get to the Davison's chamber, of which on the south side of that wall, this is looking from the Grand Gallery up. Just as a quick run through on these for the viewers here, Richard. All right, this is a closer, and then as we move up, then we see a bag of rocks. These bag of rocks are what are interesting. Not only are the rocks here, but the wires that are traveling up this wall. Alright. This wire will travel up the wall and go on up above the video cameras. This is a good shot of the rocks. Another one of the rocks. And here we have the video camera looking at a wall that's supposed to be watching tourists.
Larry, may I interrupt you?
Yes, sir.
Would you tell the audience, for the sake of time, please, what all of this means?
Well, it means that they're trying to get in and finish off these sequences that Vance was talking about when he's describing the phoenix as a bird that has destroyed itself, but in the mercury, or the, what is the element you said, Vance?
Myrrh.
Well, in Egypt, they call it mercury, and they bring the genies with it. But this myrrh and this egg is sort of the symbolic transferring of the power of that phoenix to someone. And I don't think that Zahi Hawass and the group that are up there going through the methods that they're going through are the ones that all this is for. There's someone out there for sure that's supposed to receive this and bring the Age of Enlightenment to humanity. And it's in the openness and the rightfulness of which we proceed that can take place in the open with eyes and awarenesses of all humanity, because
It isn't for their own personal egos or their own personal ideas.
Art?
Yes.
This is Dick Hogan. What this all comes down to is simply that something is going to happen. There are components on Mars tonight called Pathfinder. There are components in Egypt, the secret tunneling. There are components here in Phoenix. And there are relics we have put in the 20th century at a place called Tranquility Base on the Moon. The celestial cartography at 4:55 p.m. GMT on the 20th makes all of those mean something. And someone is getting ready for something to happen. And our presentation in Phoenix tonight is a wake-up call for people to pay attention.
Well, all right. So something is going to occur, whether it be metaphoric or real, and we should all be watching for it. And all of the research that you have done, Richard, points toward something occurring, something very important, something for all of mankind. So you're
keep this in mind. This could be nothing as more complicated as simply a contest for transfer of power from the ancient Egyptian motif to the new phoenix of the United States of America and the ushering in of a brand new, real new age. That could be what this war with Hawass and all us guys has been about all along, and we're just beginning to figure out the pieces of this puzzle.
And with this panel, we're real close, because I didn't have any idea when I landed that airplane that I would be in Phoenix, as you said. But you said he doesn't know it, he's going to be here. Hi, everybody, I'm here. This is a photograph the next day back to the overhead. After we got our rocks and did our research, this is how I looked in Egypt, ladies and gentlemen. I've cut my hair and I finished my work. So now I'm ready to tell everybody about it, and I wanted to look good for you.
All right, how much time do we have left in this half hour?
Just about none, Richard. We're coming to the end of it.
Okay. Let me give you one new piece of data. On the web this afternoon is a letter, a three-page letter posted by one of the Shore Expedition, a scientist named Tom Danley, who was an acoustic specialist who was crawling around in those upper chambers last November.
So in other words, everybody should go take a look at that.
They should go take a look at it.
All right, Richard, we are out of time.
Excuse me, I've got to say something. There's a ton of gold underneath Phoenix. That's what this is about.
All right. Hold on. This country, Linda Moulton Howe and Doug Ruby are going to be my guests, but right now we're going back to kind of finish up properly at the Civic Plaza Ballroom in Phoenix, Arizona, with Richard Hoagland and company. Richard, are you there?
We are here, Art.
All right. We've got about 15 minutes, Richard. Go ahead.
Well, let me start with the experiment that you inadvertently performed that seems to prove, or at least is suggestive, that there's something very special about the Great Pyramid itself. Why don't you and Larry kind of discuss what happened when he provided you a piece of the rock?
A piece of the rock, all right. Larry, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Here's how it happened, ladies and gentlemen. The bags that you have seen in Phoenix and that people have seen on the Internet were full of rocks, which we believe have come from this dig going from the king's to the queen's chamber. In other words, from the middle of the pyramid. Larry sent me a piece of this rock. And when I received it, he suggested that if I wanted to, I should try an experiment and take a watch with a luminous dial. I'm sure everybody's seen them. When exposed to the light and taken into a dark location, they will, of course, glow for a period of time. But as an hour or 2 hours will go by, that glow will begin to diminish until it finally more or less goes away. So I did an experiment in a closet here, and allowed the watch to become dim. I then went back in and took this piece of rock, this piece of granite, and put it adjacent to the watch, which then suddenly began to glow brightly. And, of course, that concerned me. I'm just a layman. So the first thing I did was I ran outside, living here in the desert, and picked up every kind of rock I could find and took that in there, trying to create a similar condition, and I was unable to do so. So the bottom line is, the rock would appear to have some sort of properties that I certainly don't understand. I mentioned this in an offhand way to Richard Hoagland, who just about went through the roof when he heard it, and I said, well, it wasn't my discovery, Richard. Larry suggested that I try it because he had had a similar experience while in the Great Pyramid. And that's about it, folks. I was amazed. I'm still amazed. Larry?
Well, they don't let us get near the areas that let our watches glow. They put locks and bars and have basically closed the pyramid off quite a bit now. But in the area, so everybody will understand where I'm looking, overhead, this is the descending passage on the pyramid, the subterranean chamber you're familiar with, right, Art?
Yes.
There's a dead-end passage about 52 feet back into what's considered solid masonry. At this point, I'm laying on the ground for about 2 or 3 hours. There's a lot of activity going on. I'm listening to people in the king's chamber send sounds down to me, which didn't make any sense if this is all solid. And over the years, I now find out there's a room in here about 250 feet. Up at this level, on the south side of this room here, up in this region, above the king's chamber, you have where these rocks come from, Art, that your experiments are doing what they're doing. But my experiments with my watch were down here, and the watch was glowing so bright that it literally illuminated the ceiling or this of this passage here.
All right, does this suggest to us that there is radioactivity, or what in the world does this suggest?
We're dealing with technologies that we don't know about.
I hate to bring up an interesting word, but I think we're dealing with hyperdimensional physics, all right? What I've done with my piece of limestone is to take and put it in a shoebox. Yes, we can still find shoeboxes in a dark closet. Closets are going to be very in after this. I put it on a piece of phosphorescent day glow kind of stickums, little stars, that was painted with phosphorescent paint, but without any radioactivity, just the phosphor art, and nothing happened. You have to have a radioactive source plus the phosphor for the limestone to interact with. Now, we showed a video here at the beginning of our program from Good Morning America of the Patterson power cell demonstration where the radioactivity of a uranium isotope was decreased in about an hour and a half.
That's correct.
By a factor of 2, which is impossible according to current physics. What you have inadvertently helped us stumble across is a fundamental property of the Great Pyramid at Giza in this Tura limestone being excavated and carted out, if we can look at the overhead, which is appearing, by the way, every video that, or every visual we're showing here in the auditorium is being seen by, I don't know how many million people on the internet all over the world, even as we show it to you. In those bags, those burlap bags, which Larry and his associate were able to purloin pieces such as this sitting on the stage, the 7.5 pounder, there's something remarkable about that limestone. It's been subjected to some kind of process that's not normal in the physics that we think we know. Now, part of the excuse that Dr. Hawass and others are making for the presence of all the activity in the pyramid at present is that they are bringing the limestone in to restore the interior chambers. This, according to this physics, is not true. The limestone is going out, it's not going in, because it has this remarkable property, which is part of the hyperdimensional model, deriving in part, by the way, from Stan Tenen's work. I want to give him proper credit here.
Yes.
For what the pyramid itself was meant to do.
All right, and that's a good place for us to end up, Richard. What exactly is your best guess with regard to what the pyramid, as you put it, is supposed to do?
If I'm correct, and this physics is what we think it is, this massive 6.5 million tons of highly geometric limestone. Remember, Stan pointed out that the pyramid replicates in its external geometry the internal geometry of the very crystal, the very mineral, calcium carbonate limestone of which it is composed. That dimple, 6.5 million ton dimple, was built at a specific latitude at 30 degrees north on a spinning, rotating hypersphere we call planet Earth. And some ancient technology was used to activate it, to pump it up, to make it vibrate so that its hyperdimensional properties as a pump, as a gate, as a duct, as a Stargate movie, anyone, could be in tune. What you have helped us move further down the road to proving, Art, is that this pyramid and what's going on there and this overall pattern connecting the whole solar system on July 20th is not accidental. There's something big going on here, and we have to, pardon the pun, stay tuned.
Stay tuned. All right, so a large event, metaphoric or real, will occur somewhere between the 20th and the 26th, and all of this is connected back to Giza and to the pyramids. And would that be a quick and dirty summary?
That's an excellent summary.
All right, Richard and everybody in Phoenix, I'm sure you will continue. I want to thank you all for all you have done and for all your work, and it's been great to have you on. Okay, that's it. Good night, all in Phoenix. And coming up shortly, Linda Moulton Howe.